Hey everyone, this is Hannah. This is Texas 1031, and this is a Texas True Crime Podcast. Today, I will be telling you about the wrongful convictions of Elizabeth Ramirez, Cassandra Rivera, Christy Mayhew, and Anna Vasquez in San Antonio, Texas, in the midst of the satanic panic era of the 1980s and 1990s. I've been wanting to cover this case for a while, so I'm glad I'm finally getting around to it. I honestly can't remember where I first learned about this story exactly. I think it was probably just lumped in and told kind of in short with several other satanic panic stories in a podcast I had listened to, but I'm going to tell you the full thing. So anyways, it's been raining like crazy in Houston, and it still is while I'm recording this, and my dogs are in my room because they're both scared. So this one will probably be kind of noisy because of just all the ambient shit going on. But whatever, it was the only time my husband wasn't home. So I guess we'll all just have to deal with it. So picture it, San Antonio, Texas, 1994. After she turned 16, Elizabeth Ramirez began to stay out later, experiment with drugs, date boys, and fight with her mother, Gloria. One night, Liz even stole some of her mother's prescription anxiety pills and overdosed. Gloria took her daughter to the hospital and then kicked her out of the house shortly thereafter. Liz was legally disowned by her mother, and she moved in with her sister, Rosemary, who was then living with Javier Limon and their young children. But Liz soon found problems there as well. Javier was overbearing, creepy, and constantly lectured her about the do's and don'ts of life. Javier also crossed the line on numerous occasions with compliments and flirtation. So feeling just as uncomfortable as she did living with her mother, Liz left her sister's home and moved in with a friend from school. Liz and her friend grew close, and with Liz beginning to realize she was attracted to women, the two girls eventually started dating. Liz knew that being a lesbian would make her an outsider in her conservative Catholic family. It was the early 90s, and being gay was still very taboo in many places in the world, especially the South. At school, though, coming out wasn't as stressful or awkward, since nobody really talked about it. Despite being somewhat voluntarily separated from her mother and sister, Liz remained close to her other siblings, buying her little brother Mark clothes and giving her little sister Monica advice. Even though she enjoyed giving gifts to her family, money was tight, and at various times Liz had to hold down multiple jobs at Taco Cabana, Arby's, and HEB. For our non-Texas listeners, or I guess even some parts of Texas, you don't even know this, HEB is a grocery store chain, so info. However, 6 months before graduating, overwhelmed with her work schedule, Liz dropped out of high school. In other ways, though, Liz's life was starting to look up. After moving out, her relationship with her mother had drastically improved, and Gloria went so far as to co-sign for Elizabeth's new apartment. Though her attraction to women made her still somewhat of an outsider at home, it also led Liz to new friendships. While working at HEB, she got to know Christy Mayhew, who was born in Montana and moved to San Antonio at the age of 3 when her father was transferred to the Randolph Air Force Base. Christy's parents were divorced, and her mother, like Liz's, was uncomfortable with her daughter's sexual orientation. So Liz and Christy moved into Liz's new apartment together as friends. At HEB, the women met Cassie Rivera, who, before dating women, had a son and a daughter and then split with their father. Like Liz, Cassie's mother had also kicked her out of the house, so Cassie stayed sometimes at Liz and Christy's apartment. Last on our list here is Anna Vasquez. Anna had played sports with Liz in high school and stayed friends into their 20s. Anna was working at Little Caesars, where Cassie met her one night when she went to pick up a pizza. Both women later described that it was love at first sight. Though Anna's family was more accepting than the others, she still remembered gawking looks whenever she and Cassie would stroll together at carnivals and social events in town. Carnivals, man, that's the most Texas thing. Eventually, the two would move in together, and Anna would treat Cassie's two kids as her own. Anna, who was incredibly intelligent, applied to nursing school. Cassie, who worked at AutoZone and frequented car shows, thought about becoming a mechanic. Christy wanted to return to veterinarian school at Texas A&M if she could find the money. Liz, however, still wasn't sure what she wanted to do, and she struggled with her new identity. After splitting with her first girlfriend, Liz started dating a man named Hector. He liked to party, and Liz's workaholic lifestyle drove them apart. But not before she became pregnant with his son. Though she hadn't prepared to become a young mother, she still knew she could rely on her three close friends, Christy, Anna, and Cassie, for help. The women were taking life day by day, sometimes simply just surviving from one to the next. But soon their mundane lives would come crashing down upon them, leaving them wishing that they only had their simple worries to deal with. 20-year-old Liz was 4 months pregnant when she heard a knock at her apartment door. Liz had just gotten home from a shift at Arby's where she had recently been promoted to manager. A man was standing outside her small apartment and introduced himself as Detective Thomas Majeka. Definitely a Forensic Files name because of the spelling, M-A-T-J-E-K-A, but the T is silent, I don't know. I had a friend in junior high whose last name was Majeka, and there is a J in there. Just find where it fits. Similar vibes and spelling, so anyway. He was from the San Antonio Police Department's homicide unit. Majeka was helping investigate a sex crime and asked if Liz would come to the station to answer a few questions. She was confused, but willingly went with the detective in his vehicle. Sorry for that weird noise. I don't know if that picked up on the microphone or not. It sounds like they're doing some sort of power tool experiment in my attic right now. I'm assuming it's some sort of glitch from the thunderstorm, but there could be somebody up there doing God knows what. My worst fear. Anyway, that's what that was, I think. After the two arrived back at the police station, Detective Majeka asked Liz if she knew a man named Javier Limon and his two daughters. Of course she did. Javier was her sister's ex-boyfriend, and the two daughters were her 7 and 9-year-old nieces, Vanessa and Stephanie. She saw the girls quite often. About a month before, they had even spent a week visiting at her apartment. This is just what she and her family did. You'd stay several days at a time with family members rather than just, you know, a weekend evening or only on holidays. Detective Majeka became less friendly with Liz. He explained to her that her nieces were accusing her and several of her friends who had also been at the apartment that week of sexually abusing them. Liz was shocked and confused and immediately denied the accusation. Continuing his questioning, Detective Majeka began to pry even further into Liz's personal life, documenting all of her answers on his computer. He asked if she had been in a lesbian relationship. She said yes. Had she ever left her nieces under the care of her friends, and were those friends also lesbians? She answered yes to both. Detective Majeka paused his typing to implore Liz with a quick threat. He told her that if she had abused her nieces, her son, who was due to be born in just a few months, would most likely be taken by authorities. Even with this threat, Liz was adamant that she never sexually abused Vanessa and Stephanie. One morning, several days later, in September of 1994, Cassie and Anna met at a park. Anna broke the news to her longtime girlfriend that they, too, were being accused of sexually assaulting Liz's nieces. Christy Mayhew was at her mother's apartment in Rosenberg, just outside of Houston, when the police surrounded the building and ordered her out. She was also being implicated of sexually abusing the two girls she had helped Liz with while they visited their aunt. In March of 1995, all four were indicted for sexually assaulting Liz's nieces, and all four maintained their innocence while trying to remember if anything out of the ordinary had happened the week Vanessa and Stephanie had stayed at Liz's apartment. They realized that the four of them had rarely been in the apartment at the same time, because they were so busy with long shifts at various jobs at odd hours. Yet the girls were claiming that all four women were present for the assault. When offered plea deals of 10 years probation, they all refused and decided to go to trial. That's kind of a crazy plea deal, if you ask me. Like, if it were a man being accused of abusing two girls, he fucking sure as shit wouldn't have been offered probation. So I think the plea deal alone shows, I don't know, maybe not, because we will see how this transpires. But I kind of think that it shows that the DA and the system have doubts about the allegations, like, right off the bat. But anyway, the women were still baffled. You know, where had these accusations even come from? Liz had a theory. The girl's father, Javier Limon, who had dated her sister Rosemary before a messy breakup, as I mentioned before, had always been making advances towards her, even when she was in high school. He would offer Liz rides, he would give her small amounts of cash when she needed it, and he would leave long messages on her answering machine. In the months prior to the allegations, Javier had been sending her love letters filled with lies about them being intimate. Javier even approached Liz, telling her that he would take care of her and the baby when he was born, and that he wanted to essentially be the child's father. The love letters that Javier wrote referred to Elizabeth as my little angel and included bits of poetry. That is just so gross. Never write anyone poetry. Like, shut up. What year are we in? They asked her to keep secrets and instructed her to call at specific times, between 7 and 7:15 a.m. or 5:45 and 6 p.m. I hope these letters aren't upsetting, disturbing, or making you feel uncomfortable, one reads. They were signed, Javier Limon. In their opinion, Liz's friends believed she could have done more to reject Javier's advances. Cassie recalled that Liz even promised Javier she would marry him. Christy remembers Liz accepting money for rides. Anna remembers Liz coming to her upset and describing Javier's inappropriate comments. Anna counseled her, stating, "You need to tell somebody because that's not right." Another friend said Liz kept telling her over and over that she was afraid something was going to happen with Javier. As Liz's mother, Gloria, remembers it, her daughter handed over the letters from Javier and said, "Mom, he's after me." Gloria invited Javier out to breakfast and confronted him. When he denied that the letters existed, she took them out and pointed to a signature. He put up an incredibly poor defense by simply storming away from the table. Gloria was suspicious of Javier, and she warned Liz not to take care of Javier's daughters. Liz shrugged off her mother's warning, stating, "Mama, they're my nieces. I love them." Javier was a practicing Jehovah's Witness and played down his controlling and manipulative behavior, making his actions incredibly subtle but effective. Despite his timid and pious facade, though, Liz wasn't having any of it. He was her sister's ex-boyfriend, for God's sake, and she didn't need his help with her new baby or in her love life. Furthermore, Liz wasn't even interested in men. She wholeheartedly rejected Javier and told him no. Liz believed that what the women were being confronted with now and being accused of was Javier's revenge. Liz had told Detective Majeka about Javier's advances, but he hadn't thought much of it. Shocker. So she decided to tell her lawyer about Javier. Maybe the lawyer could explain to the authorities that no crime had actually occurred. It was just a vengeful accusation orchestrated by this jilted man. Her attempt, though, would be fruitless. In the midst of her legal troubles, Liz gave birth to her son. 3 days later, they took Liz to jail. "The most painful memory of that day was being separated from my newborn son," she later said. "The arresting officers wouldn't even let me kiss him goodbye." Liz's trial would begin in 1997, wherein Vanessa, the eldest of the two sisters, now 12 years old, testified. She claimed that after several carefree days in her aunt's apartment, Elizabeth called her into the bedroom one afternoon and began shouting at her. Vanessa said that the group of women had been drinking tequila and were topless. There were liquids and powders and different things in the room, along with syringes and vials of white powder. She said the four women held her down and began kissing her and putting cold, quote-unquote, liquid stuff inside her, and then they inserted a tampon into her vagina. Vanessa then told the jury that Liz produced a gun. Next, her father Javier called, and as Vanessa assured him that everything at Aunt Liz's house was going just fine, her aunt held the gun to her head. Then Liz ordered her to take a shower. From the bathroom, she heard screams from her younger sister, Stephanie. Vanessa said that she tried to get out, but the door was locked, which doesn't really make sense because you can't lock the door from the outside, but okay, Vanessa. Elizabeth's lawyer, Freddie Ruiz, tried to get Vanessa to say that she was mixed up and that the gun had actually been wielded by her father, Javier, in Colorado. He explained that Vanessa had offered a, quote, confabulation of facts and a jumbling of things, weapons, bedrooms, and hatred towards family, end quote. Freddie Ruiz theorized that Javier had held a gun to her mother Rosemary's head years before in Denver, and that this had been refracted in the child's mind to include her Aunt Liz. That's kind of a bold statement from a lawyer, but I guess he can be a medical expert too, or a psychological expert. This account was backed up by Oscar, Rosemary's partner in Denver, as well as Rosemary herself in police interviews. Rosemary even testified under oath at the trial that Javier had arrived in Denver and threatened her with a gun. At the trial, Dr. Nancy Kellogg, who really just kind of fucks it up for everybody, honestly. A professor of pediatrics at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio was the prosecution's expert witness. Sorry, not sorry. Dr. Kellogg estimated that she had examined roughly 3,500 sexual assault victims, most of them children. She testified that she examined the girls and saw evidence of a healed scar on Vanessa's hymen. Dr. Kellogg testified this scar was definitive physical evidence of sexual molestation. In her notes, she even speculated that the acts were quote-unquote satanic-related. Okay. Although Dr. Kellogg admitted on cross-examination that even though she couldn't tell how old the scar was or whether it was the result of an accident, she still insisted the scar indicated sexual abuse, 100%. Liz nervously but proudly took the stand in her own defense, and her trial lasted only a couple of days. Testimony concluded on a Friday afternoon, and the jury went home for the weekend, returning Monday for the closing arguments. On February 6, 1997, they found Elizabeth Ramirez guilty and recommended a sentence of 37 and a half years. "I thought she should have gotten life," said the jury foreman. "If it had been a man, I don't think there would have been much of a question," which I kind of agree with. So, allowed 5 minutes to say goodbye to her family, Liz was then escorted to a holding cell where she actually fainted. In February of 1998, just a year later, it would be Anna Cassie and Christie's turn. At this trial, both Stephanie and Vanessa would testify. The prosecutor, Mary Kay Delavan, reminded the jury that much time had passed. The alleged abuse was almost 4 years ago, so the victims, quote, may not be able to keep everything perfectly straight, end quote. So that's reassuring. Vanessa's testimony for this trial muddled the facts that she had presented a year before. Now Christie had been at the apartment, where before she hadn't. Now it was Anna who wielded the gun, not Elizabeth, which, like, no comment. We'll get through this. Stephanie didn't help or clarify the situation. In her original statement to police, there hadn't been a gun, but now there was one. Before, there had been other little kids, Cassie's kids and some neighbors. They were also in the apartment throughout the week, but now she was adamant that she and her sister had been the only children. Again, the prosecutors accounted for the inconsistencies by saying the girls were young children who could hardly be expected to keep facts straight. They literally just proved the defense's point, but okay. Vanessa even claimed that the court reporter must have incorrectly taken down her remarks at Elizabeth's trial. That's bold. Some of the discrepancies came from Serafina Limon, Javier's mother, who initially reported the girls' outcries and allegations. During the trial for Cassie, Christie, and Anna, there was far less talk of lesbianism. It was mentioned mostly by the defense attorneys, who attempted to show that the relationships between women have nothing to do with pedophilia. Prosecutor Delavan said she wasn't prosecuting the women for their sexual orientation. Quote, "I remember reporters at the time wanting to know if we were trying these women because they were lesbians, which was ludicrous. It was really an offensive question," end quote, which I guess, great prosecutor, you scored a couple points there, but whatever. Cassie remembers her lawyer telling the women that they would surely win, and they were coaching them to just, like, don't jump up and down, stay calm when the jury announces an acquittal. However, on Valentine's Day of 1998, all three were convicted of the same crimes as Elizabeth: aggravated sexual assault of a child and indecency with a child. They were each sentenced to 15 years, but the judge decided they could remain out of prison until their appeals had been exhausted, which I think is a pretty good, you know, chill move on the judge's part, despite how he acts years later, which we'll get into. As their families paid lawyers to file appeals, Cassie and Anna, still very much in love, set out together to investigate the case on their own. Cassie and Anna tried to recreate what happened the week of the alleged crimes. They wrote down the events of the week on a large white poster board in a grid organized by each woman and by day. According to the summary of the whiteboard, Liz had just learned of her pregnancy and was recovering from a car accident. The women traded cars so each could get to work, bought hot dogs for the kids, and played basketball at the park. Shifts at Arby's for Liz, shifts at AutoZone for Cassie, swimming with the kids. Christie, still unemployed, pawned a radio. They took Liz's niece to Walmart, where they bought a fish. The next day, the fish died, and they returned it. Their reinvestigation was uneventful. There's even a home video from the period shortly before Christy, Cassie, and Anna went to prison in 2000. At one point in the video, the sound of wind and cars passing on the highway accompanies a shot of an empty lot. Cassie and Anna are looking for Elizabeth's old apartment in a further attempt at recreating what happened back in 1994. The camera frame next shows a wiry, bearded man who tells Cassie and Anna the apartment building was torn down due to owner neglect. The scene of the crime had vanished. When 2000 rolled around and their prison sentences began, the women were each sent to different prisons throughout the state. None of them were able to communicate with each other, as prisoners writing other prisoners was forbidden. Each were all given higher security levels, including at one point more than 30 days in solitary confinement for Anna because she refused to take sex offender rehabilitation classes. The families did their best to move on. Obviously, holidays and birthdays were the hardest. Rosemary, Liz's sister, got a job supervising the cleaning staff at the courthouse downtown. Every other day, she cleaned the office of her sister's prosecutor, Philip Kazin, a stark and sad reminder of her sister's fate. All four of the women similarly described their emotional transition in prison. Initially, they felt rage and bewilderment, but over time, they slowly began to feel acceptance and quiet resolve. Anna even said, quote, "I tried writing the Innocence Projects and Oprah and Maury Povich and Montel, really anybody who would listen. I never heard anything back," end quote. Elizabeth spent her time scouring medical and legal textbooks in the prison library and spent nearly all of her commissary money on stamps, trying to write letters to those who could possibly help and support her. She never got a response back either. More than a decade later, in 2011, Cassie was transferred to the hobby unit in Marlin, where Anna and Elizabeth had recently been living. Cassie saw Liz for the first time at a Catholic mass held in the prison's church. Around the same time, Anna was put on maintenance duty and assigned to fix the lights in Cassie's cell. The couple had ended their relationship long ago, but it was still an incredible moment to see one another again. Cassie's son and daughter continued to drive 3 hours up I-35 to visit her in prison, but Elizabeth had lost contact with her son when he was 5 after his father obtained custody. Prison was a place of endless routine, and so she started one of her own. Every Sunday, Liz would write her son a letter and have her mother deliver it. However, years went by without a response. The much-needed twist in this story came when Daryl Otto sent his first letter. He really wasn't sure who would respond, if they would at all. All he knew was her name was Elizabeth Ramirez and that she was an inmate in a Texas prison, 3,700 miles from his cabin in Canada's frigid Yukon Territory. She had been convicted of a crime, but the crime didn't make much sense, and he also knew that women rarely go to prison for sexually abusing children. He let the letter sit on his desk for a week before he put it in the mail. Daryl taught courses on natural resources at Yukon College. He lived alone 40 miles outside of Whitehorse, the territory's capital, and at 30,000 residents, its largest city. Daryl was in his 50s and lived without reliable electricity or running water. His primary company was a group of huskies. At one point, he had as many as 40 of them, and he would haul 5-gallon buckets from a nearby river for them to drink. It was like living in a labor camp, he said. As a teenager, Daryl had hitchhiked across the continent, but by 25, he was tired and wanted to settle down. He finished college, got a master's degree, and took the teaching job in the remote Yukon. With a lot of time on his own, Daryl developed various research obsessions outside his academic work on fish breeding. He also found criminals particularly fascinating, especially the psychologically obscure because, like him, they were on the fringes of society. He had checked out a video from the college library on female sexual predators. Most of the time, as he learned from reading scientific journals, these women are teachers who fall in love with a student. It was very rare for a woman to abuse a young child, and if they do, it often means the perpetrator has a serious mental or personality disorder. But as he scanned the articles on the internet on female predator subject matter, there was one case that didn't fit the pattern. It involved four women from San Antonio. One of them, Elizabeth Ramirez, had a profile on the website writeaprisoner.com. About a month after he sent Liz a letter, Daryl came home from work to find her response in the mail. The letter was several pages long and written in clear cursive script. It was chatty and surprisingly upbeat. More letters followed, each one taking about 2 weeks between his home and Elizabeth's prison in Marlin. Liz told Daryl about Javier, her trial, and about the guilt she felt for her friend's prison sentences. Daryl was initially somewhat skeptical. He was writing a convicted prisoner, after all. He asked her the same questions in letter after letter to see if her answers remained consistent, and they did. After establishing a surface-level but friendly relationship with Liz, Daryl decided to make a huge decision. He would travel to Texas and visit Liz in prison to get a better sense of who she really was. When Elizabeth first came out behind the glass to meet him, she couldn't stop shaking, and after months of letters, the two would finally meet. Daryl had founded an organization called the National Center for Reason and Justice, which was created in the wake of the 1980s era satanic ritual abuse scandals to advocate for people wrongfully accused of harming children. His packet of information about the women's case ended up on the desk of Debbie Nathan, a journalist who wrote the groundbreaking book on the satanic scandals titled Satan's Silence. That's a lot of S's. She also assisted Daryl's organization in vetting which cases they took on. As many of us know, since the early 1980s, the United States had seen numerous accusations, investigations, and trials of daycare workers and other adults for supposedly engaging in ritual satanic abuse, including the rape, murder, and torture of children. I know you can maybe hear me laughing. It's not that I don't take this stuff seriously. I just feel like it's probably untrue. And if it is, it's incredibly rare. So anyway, within these cases, there was seldom evidence other than the statements of children or adults who, quote unquote, recovered memories from their youth. By the time of Stephanie and Vanessa's outcries, these public dramas had really kind of largely died out. But remember, though, Dr. Kellogg in her exam notes had written that this could be this crime, these scars, these marks, this could be satanic related. Debbie Nathan brought the case to the Innocence Project of Texas, where well-known attorney Jeff Blackburn agreed to represent the women. But little happened for a year. Then Mike Ware, another lawyer with the Innocence Project, got involved. Mike had worked for years within the Conviction Integrity Unit at the Dallas County District Attorney's Office, which investigated old cases for possible wrongful convictions and helped exonerate dozens of men. Debbie contacted family members and others connected to the case, and Daryl sought out reporters and published a short essay of his own on Texas Monthly's website. Michelle Mondo, Forensic Files, a crime reporter at the San Antonio Express News, read Daryl's piece and began investigating herself. Shockingly, Michelle said, quote, "I called all of the women's previous attorneys, and they didn't even remember the case," end quote. Michelle spent more than a year on the story, reporting much of it in her spare time. She discovered that Javier's two daughters had made abuse allegations before in Denver, but then claimed at Elizabeth's trial to not remember having done so. Michelle's front page story came out but made little impact. Despite this, the pool of advocates for the women was growing. Debbie Nathan convinced a filmmaker she had mentored named Deborah Eskenazi to take a look at the case. Deborah became passionately involved, collecting footage for a documentary that would become vital in the case's progression and the later exoneration of the women. Shortly after Michelle's story appeared in the news came the breakthrough. Stephanie Lamone, the younger of the two accusers, called Debbie Nathan and recanted. She said that her father, Javier, had coached her to make the accusations. Stephanie now said the women had never abused her. In the backseat of a car, Stephanie, now married and going by Stephanie Martinez, read from a sheet of notebook paper. It was August 2012, and Stephanie, then 25, was a mother herself. Deborah Eskenazi sat in the front seat and held a camera as Stephanie read. Quote, "I remember everything Javier coached me to say, as well as my grandmother, Serafina. I'm sorry it has taken this long for me to know what truly happened. You must understand, I was threatened, and I was told that if I did tell the truth that I would end up in prison, taken away, and even get my ass beat. I will make things right, and I am sorry for everything I put you through. I was only 7, and I was scared. End quote. Stephanie would soon find herself in a legal battle of her own. An allegation was filed with CPS that she and her husband were fighting violently in front of their children, and that was grounds for removal to foster care. Michelle Mondo published a story strongly implying that Javier filed the allegation as punishment for Stephanie's recantation. However, when Javier testified in court on the matter, he claimed that the police filed the CPS report, not him. Javier believed that his daughter didn't recant because she suddenly changed her mind about what happened to her. He explained that she threatened to recant to hurt him because they had recently been fighting and that Stephanie was simply taking advantage of his kindness. Okay. By late 2012, media attention on the women who were becoming known as the San Antonio Four was steadily growing. Adding to the attention was the surprise decision that Anna was being released on parole in November. After Anna was freed from prison, she spoke to reporters at her childhood home where a few neighbors watched from a distance as she sat on the front steps and talked to a local TV anchor. He asked to film her walking around the yard and she complied, but she wouldn't stick one foot past the curb for the camera to symbolize her freedom since it would technically violate her parole conditions. She was still a convicted sex offender, and there was a long list of parole rules. No cell phones, no computers, no contact with anyone under 18. Her brother even got her a job at his auto shop, but she had to quit when they discovered it was near a school. Anna finally found a job at a tortilla factory, but still tried to raise awareness about the case in her free time, all the while feeling residual guilt that she was out when the other girls were still suffering in prison. But because she was out, Anna became their spokeswoman. She would participate in local fundraisers and try to get as much publicity regarding the case as possible. She was desperate to get her friends released and to receive redemption and justice. Roughly a year later, in October of 2013, attorney Mike Ware filed writs for all four women. Though he mentioned Stephanie's recantation and mistakes made by police officers and lawyers involved in the original trial, his primary argument was that Dr. Kellogg's testimony was inaccurate since the medical understanding of what constitutes evidence of sexual abuse had recently changed. A month prior, in September, a new state law had taken effect. It had passed in the spring by the Texas legislature. The statute made it easier to challenge convictions based on outdated forensic evidence. Lawmakers passed the measure with a host of recent scandals in mind, including debates over arson science, the use of dog sense in police lineups, and shaken baby syndrome. The San Antonio Four case was one of the first tests for the new statute. Crucially, Dr. Kellogg even told the Bexar County District Attorney's Office that her initial claims at the trial were outdated and that she wouldn't offer the same testimony if the women were tried again. At least she's making up for what she fucked up before. Dr. Kellogg's admission suddenly undermined the key evidence in the case. District Attorney Susan Reed agreed that the women could be released on bond pending further legal wrangling in the spring and that she wouldn't attempt a retrial. They also wouldn't face sex offender restrictions. The fight wasn't over quite yet, but progress was being made. It was November 18th, and they had been waiting since that morning, having skipped lunch because the release seemed imminent. A friend had brought 10 outfits on hangers, including black slacks and blouses in various shades of blue and gold so the women could pick out what they'd like to wear. Anna joined her friends, Cassie, Christy, and Elizabeth, and they would all emerge from the jail holding hands in a line with Mike Ware. It was nearly silent, except for little clusters of words between sobs. Cassie, along with Christy, had been in prison for 13 years. Elizabeth had been incarcerated nearly 17. The first days back were strange, but familiar. Liz savored a strawberry shake from McDonald's and watched a Spurs game on television. Cassie went to a cookout for her son's birthday. The new technology was fascinating, but so were the new social norms. They stared in awe as two women kissed openly at a convenience store. Gay rights activists treated them like rock stars. Strangers congratulated them. When Elizabeth went to get a haircut, the hairdresser wouldn't let her pay. 2 days after their release, the women appeared at a hastily arranged press conference. Surrounded by cameras from local and national media outlets, the women thanked the DA's office and the media. They also thanked Daryl Otto over and over again, though none of the reporters asked about him. The lawyer standing in a row behind them answered the big picture questions about the new state law and the legal actions to come, but they were careful to say little about Javier and his daughters. In April of 2015, the judge who presided over the second trial of Anna, Christie, and Cassie in 1998 held an evidentiary hearing on the issue of actual innocence of all four women. Which is fucking crazy to me, and maybe it has to be that way because he presided over the first one. I don't know, I just feel like it's a conflict of interest when all is said and done. Like, he already ruled that these women were guilty 15 years ago, so I don't know. My opinion is get someone with a new perspective, at least pretend to be fair, but I'm sure that there's some legality that I'm unaware of. Anyways, shocker, in February 2016, that same judge declined to recommend that the women be found actually innocent. Big surprise. He said that the evidence, quote unquote, fell short of the bar. Even though Dr. Kellogg admitted she provided incorrect and faulty evidence and testimony in the earlier trials, this judge doubled down and defended Dr. Kellogg, saying that her original expert opinion was not junk science, and said that it was incredibly disrespectful and discrediting to make Dr. Kellogg's opinion and testimony sound incorrect, even though she did that to herself. Like, fuck right off, dude. She's the doctor, not you. She may not be the best one, but she still is one, and you're not. So now the women are shitting their pants because everyone is on their side except for this one old fucking white guy that holds all of the cards and makes all of the decisions. So as a literal last resort, the women appealed to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. All there was to do was wait. In April of 2016, the documentary film by Deborah Eskenazi titled Southwest of Salem, The Story of the San Antonio Four, premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. In the months following, the documentary received critical acclaim and support among viewers who helped donate to the Act Now campaign to contact the district attorney's office. Audiences also helped sign the hashtag FreeTheSA4 petition on change.org, which reached over 25,000 signatures by November. The documentary even went on to receive several awards. I was able to find it on Peacock. That's where I watched it. It was really good, very sad, but very well done. On November 23rd, 2016, after the film gained attention and established itself as a key influencer in the case moving forward, the San Antonio Four were finally exonerated of all charges, with the film cited in the first paragraph of the court's opinion. Judge David Newell of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals wrote, quote, "Those defendants have won the right to proclaim to the citizens of Texas that they did not commit a crime, that they are innocent, that they deserve to be exonerated," end quote. 2 years later, on December 3rd, 2018, the four women had their criminal records expunged and became eligible to collect $80,000 each in restitution from the state of Texas for every year they were wrongfully imprisoned, which I guess is pretty good in the grand scheme of things. So some final thoughts on this case really quick. Christy Mayhew said something while she was still in prison that I thought was perfectly fitting. Quote, "We had come to prison and have been lost and forgotten. Stephanie has admitted that all of this never happened, but is afraid to cooperate to help us because her father, Javier, is the one who created this lie and has threatened his own daughters to stick with this story. I believe if anything ever did happen to Stephanie and Vanessa, it was by their father," end quote. Another woman in the documentary, I didn't write down her name because I suck, but she said that the allegations were almost like the plot and scenes from a porn. And more specifically, the details were like if a straight man wrote out how he thought lesbians spent their evenings with one another. And I couldn't agree more. Like, liquids and powders and syringes and tampons, like, what the fuck? Like, how is that believable? And I mean, I guess you could construe it as the liquids were like alcohol and the powders were drugs and syringes and tampons are syringes and tampons. But I just, it's not realistic. It doesn't sound anything like abuse or satanic ritual abuse. Like, what the fuck? Where's the altar? Where's the goat head? Where's the sacrificial baby? Where's the, like, daggers? Like, I don't, like, the quintessential shit isn't even there. What are you fucking talking about? How did this case go on for 15 plus years? I don't know. It's so tragic. In case you were wondering, Javier Limón is out free in the world living his life in Houston, I believe, according to his Facebook page, easily findable. And he really has suffered zero consequences from this. He is voluntarily in the documentary, which is interesting in itself. He is a master manipulator sociopath that hates women. Like, you can just listening to him talk, he's a narcissist and he believes everything he says. It's kind of terrifying. Fuck you, Javier. But thank you to Dale Otto. Keith Hamilton, I didn't mention him, but he did play a part in this. He was involved in the Greg Kelly case that I did last year, I guess. excuse me. And also, obviously, Mike Ware and everyone at the Innocence Project of Texas. They did a great job. And that is the story of the San Antonio Four. I don't have any questions or theories on this case. There's a bunch of information out there of like what the women are up to now, but I feel like this has already been a long-winded episode. So anyways, look it up if you want, but I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have a case suggestion, email me or message me on Instagram. I think I'm going to put it out if I can get it written soon, if there's enough information out there. I have a serial killer case that I found that I think I want to talk about. So stick around for that. Happy episode 75. Crazy. But yeah, I will be back. I can't talk. I will be back with more Texas true crime. So if anyone is listening, happy Halloween.